together like jar, so it's like it's an interesting word, it's similar. Kind of like this word in the word for it, te, and it means they. You find a lot of words that are similar in Sanskrit. So Jara Sanda, who was born in two pieces and put together by Jara. So rather than being torn asunder by Jara, it was put together by Jara. He was a demoniac king. And he was worshipping the Brahman. So he actually had a lot of power from worshipping the Brahman. It wasn't that the demons did not do religious things. This is what Prabhupada's pointing out in the beginning, and then later he'll change it a little bit. But it's not that they didn't do religious sacrifices. It's not that Hiranyakashipu didn't do this yoga to please Brahma. It's not that, you know, Ravana did not please Shiva with his religious sacrifices. Usually, all the successful demons did worship the Brahmins or the all very powerful demigods. So they are intelligent religiously in material sense, but they weren't intelligent in the sense of devotion in serving Krishna. So Jarasandha was worshipping the Brahmins and respecting the Brahmins. And in his ritual, which was, so-called religious or sacrificial rites, which don't adhere to the authority of scripture. So due to these kinds of sacrifices, he was doing human sacrifices. He was sacrificing kings. So if you're a king called by Jarasandha, you're in a lot of trouble. If you're a Brahmin, no problem. You receive wealth and land and wives and cows and all sorts of things. If you were a king, though, you were starved and then sacrificed on the holy altar. So this is the nature of these demoniac people. They would concoct all sorts of rituals. And it happens a lot in India. And the interesting thing about our philosophy in the inclusive sense, or how we accept many other philosophies, is these motor human sacrifices do have the power. It's not that they don't have power, they just don't have spiritual power. They have material power. So later we'll find if you worship the ghosts, you will actually take birth amongst ghosts. You can actually get ghostly powers. But then you will miss the point and you will not attain Krishna. So there's many things like this. And Jarasandha was one of them, and Hiranyakashipu almost became immortal. Ravana almost became immortal because they were doing these activities. It was interesting because the first year students, they recently did Hinduism, introduction to Hinduism, and they learned about all these many different sects and religions in India. And it looks like Vaishnavism is just kind of one of many. And in the sense of material religion, we are one of many. In the sense of material religion, we're considered Hinduism. In the sense of spiritual religion, we're Sanatan Dharma. So Prabhupada refused to use the term Hinduism because it's a material designation. But if we were in a material designation, it would be Hinduism. So similarly, all these different demoniac people, they follow all sorts of concoctions of Sanatan Dharma, of the Vedic Dharma, of Hindu Dharma, and they sacrifice all sorts of crazy things. And also, if you go to Africa, you find voodoo and all these black magic rituals. They do all sorts of things that give them very esoteric power, but it doesn't give them higher knowledge and it doesn't give them higher spiritual strength. So in our history and in the history of the world, we see that there has been many demoniac rituals. And they have certain power, so it's interesting to note that. And as I really like the previous text, I'm kind of about it because of Krishna's speech, or he imitates the demons. So much wealth do I have today, and I will gain more according to my schemes. So much is mine now, and it will increase in the future, more and more. He is my enemy, and I have killed him. And my other enemies will also be killed. I am the lord of everything. I am the enjoyer. I am perfect, powerful and happy. I am the richest man, surrounded by aristocratic relatives. There is none so powerful and happy as I am. I shall perform sacrifices. I shall give charity, and thus I shall rejoice. So the finishing statements, he's doing pious things. The demoniac are not materially, at least not always directly materially evil. They often do many material things, but they're not spiritual. And as we were discussing before, the main purpose of this this chapter is that demoniac. Actually, the word demoniac, the word asura can also be translated to non-godly or atheist, as I said before. But basically, that's the point. If you want to use it in a heavy kind of Christian sense, as Prabhupada uses it, you use the word demoniac. But realistically, I mean, the word demon kind of means like, you know, for us it means this big ferocious monster, kind of red, scaly skin, and a pitchfork and things like that. But it means someone who's not godly. So this whole chapter is about the godly and non-godly. And these people are performing religious rituals that are not godly. So concluding that, the point is that they're doing material things and getting material benefits. And although it seems like they're doing religion, their religion is material dharma, not Sanatana dharma. But now we get into modern history of Hinduism. And we look at... Now, I can pick out two people that Prabhupada... Well, maybe more, actually, a few more. The Prabhupada is kind of directly or indirectly commenting on. Let's see if we can figure it out. I've strayed from where I'm supposed to be.
They become known as religious reformers or incarnations of God.
Yes. So who do we have there? Who can guess some? Well, here's God bless his soul, he's no longer with us. Prabhupada. I mean, I know some of the congregation of the Benelites worship God bless his soul. But Sarvabhauma Prabhupada was not interested in these people who would do magic tricks and who would claim to be God or an incarnation or even anyone like particularly amazing. You see, even not to put him in the same barrel, but you see also Jesus Christ did this. If you want to get followers easily, common followers, you do magic tricks. In India, it works. In the West now, we're all kind of like, you know, Houdini and these guys and that guys. It's kind of old news, and it's kind of like, you know, it's a little bit old-fashioned now in the West. But there are still a few people in the West, and very many people in India, very advanced academics and, you know, scientists and all sorts who believe in these people. I was watching a small documentary on Sai Baba's followers, and he has, like, you know, rich governors and doctors and physicists, and they're amazed by his production of these little trinkets, rings and bracelets and things, which he seemingly manifests. Now, if you show a performing magician, this, even in India, because they've had performing magicians since before the Western influence also, Prabhupada very much likes magic, quote-unquote, illusion, producing sleight of hand. And I have a friend who does this, and he once came and he produced a penny from a pocket. And when you see someone produce a penny from a pocket, like, yeah, from someone else's pocket, like, yeah, yeah, whatever. But when it happens to you, it's really like, how did it get into my pocket? Because you know it's a trick, but you know it's that, therefore, if it's a trick, it's false. It means they actually put it in there, and you have a penny in your pocket, and you're like, where did that come from? It's very astounding, and in early Bengal, sometimes people do these things, Bhagavan. Even the earliest non-devotees came, and they had self-heating shaving cream, and when they sprayed it in the hand of the locals, they exclaimed, Bhagavan, just see this. This amazing feat, where it's actually a chemical reaction. So I was astounded to find this coin in my pocket. It was in the holy dharma of Mayapur. It was magical. But what he'd done actually is, my friend knew him and told me, he said, did he come in contact with you at all before the trip? And that's the trick. 5 minutes before, he came and gave me a seemingly normal affectionate, friendly hug and embrace, a greeting embrace. And like, oh, buddy, how are you? And as his hands went around, he slipped it in. And then 5 minutes later, there's three other people around. He's at a distance from me, so you see he never gets anywhere close to me. And all the conversation has gone by, and then boom, there's a coin in my pocket. So there's a few little bits of film of these certain incarnations, and they're holding something, and that's, they pull out slow motion footage. When they went to the Westerners are not even into really respecting religious authorities as much as they are in India. In India, you at least, you know, externally offer respect. So to some extent they did, but all the while filming them with slow motion video cameras and capturing all their little, you know, spiritual feats. So in Shaivism there is the holy ash. It's like the ash that Shiva bathes himself in, or something like this. And these people produce this ash to the masses. It's holy. It's like, you know, we take Charamrita. It's not like there's a, you know, it's not like Charamrita is hidden in a vault and there's like a very limited supply. I mean, there is a certain amount, but you know, you can offer the Maha water, for example. It's a whole bucket of it. But it's holy. So simply they do this, they give you holy ash, just comes out of their arm, you know. But then for certain people who give certain contributions to their congregation, or who have certain traditions, they produce gold. And when I was watching this documentary, I thought that a very interesting point was this. Even the demons and demoniac people, they do charity. So if this man can produce gold and ash, and he is God, why is he not producing food for the hungry? Or, you know, or gold for everyone, in fact, not just the rich and the prestigious people. Don't the poor people? Couldn't he give it to the poor people and let them use the gold? Or maybe it's because he knows they'll receive it. But yeah, the point is very cheap tricks. It's nothing like Krishna, for example. Prabhupada said, if you want to see an incarnation of God, Krishna set the standard. They show the universal form. That's the standard. You ask them for the universal form. And if they're tricky enough, they'll say, I'll show you later. You know, or you're not ready or something.
You don't have to go to
that. You don't know. No, but you should be able to give you divine eyes. Because Krishna can give divine eyes. So, they can say you don't have divine eyes. But you should also be able to produce your divine eyes. And maybe you can at least tranquilize you or give you some LC or something to make you feel a divine experience. But we see these people are just tricksters. And the other one I saw was Vivekananda, I think a little bit in here, who united Hinduism. He's very famous for uniting Hinduism. He's big in Hinduism. He really did a lot of work for Hinduism and religion in India. His method was basically saying, we're all followers of Shankaracharya. That's how he did it, which is completely wrong for us. It's not true. There's something else here as well. Oh, and then also human armors. I did a paper on them. I did it very quickly, but I did a paper on what's called Neo-Vedanta. Because Shankaracharya, following Shankaracharya is not a small thing. Okay, his philosophy sounds simple. Everything is one and everything is illusory. But the practice is to live that life, which is the life of a sannyasi. It's to emancipate oneself from the world, knowing the world is an illusion, and to accept very rigid austerity. But these Neo-Vedantins, it's Vedantins, Advaita Vedantins, they just read Vedanta. If they do anything seemingly worldly, it's read Vedanta. Lord Chaitanya was chastised for not reading Vedanta, because he was a sannyasi. It is the duty, so it's a so-called duty of an Advaitin to be a sannyasi, and it's a so-called duty of a sannyasi to read Vedanta. Neo-Vedantins could hardly be considered Vedantins because, number one, they don't practice sannyas, or not many of them do. The leaders do. It's not that they don't have sannyasis, but the majority of them are not sannyasis. And they do not read Vedanta, nor do they advocate reading Vedanta, because they don't follow authority. They make up their own authority. And it's about feeling. We have feeling is very popular. We have feeling also in our religion, in bhakti. But we have jinn. But Prabhupada said, you know, religious sentiment without philosophy is fanaticism. And philosophy without religion is mental speculation. So these guys are kind of somewhere on both spectrums without the combination. Because we have a very rigid philosophy that supports feeling. We have very deep discussions that support feeling. These guys introduce feeling because feeling is easy to extract. Everyone has feelings. So they say your path is following your feelings. Just follow your feelings and you will find God. Scripture? Put it out. The most valuable scripture is to advocate that following your feelings is bona fide. But they will not tell you to read scripture. You don't need to read Shankaracharya to be a Neo-Vedantist, to be a spiritualist. You don't need to worship the deity. You don't need to do anything. You just need to follow your heart. Your mind. You know, your heart. This is dangerous in one sense. This is, I mean, super soul is there, but how are you supposed to know that the voice of the super soul over your mind? If you're intelligent, you can reflect on your life and you can hear the super soul. And if you want to get all like, okay, it's not really the super soul, then you can hear the demigod who resembles the super soul. You can very distinctly hear a voice within your heart of either your mind or someone else. Doesn't mean you're crazy. I'm not talking full-fledged accents and you know, voices of different people with names, etc. That's something else. But you can very much hear guidance. And you can probably, at least in my life, I can reflect on at least a few incidents, worldly or spiritual incidents, where I was told what to do. And on some occasions... Yeah, we can, but I mentioned some last time. I nearly died a few times, and then I just didn't. You know, I just needed to take one step, and I'd be in the hospital, and I didn't. But one of them was the realization, you know, that I needed to, leave home. You know, that I had the idea that my karma was handled, and that I should go and follow my spiritual and intellectual desires. But that was, and later I found that was in line with scripture. You can also be misinterpreted, but I found, okay, yes, and I don't know if I knew that before then, but I probably did. But there's, you know, I have had experiences. Also, I've had experiences where I was in a lot of romantic sentiment when I was in, you know, young teenage years, and that I was just like a dog, basically. And I had that realization, but I ignored it and said, no, man, it's just real. So I remember the little voice of the super soul said, you're kind of like a dog right now. And the voice of the mind said, no, this is just ours. Listen to me, I am the authority. So we have this understanding, but there is the voice of the heart. But without aligning yourself with spiritual authority, this could be anything. And this is just simply whims of the mind. My friend had a great terminology for it. I wish I could remember it again. Basically, it was like the religion of mental sense gratification is the way I translated it to this kind of terminology. Whereas, just whatever the mind wants, you just do it. And this is not really a philosophy. I mean, it is a philosophy, but it's not really a successful philosophy. But this is the philosophy that they're propagating. And, you know, who knows what sorts of desires people have. I mean, what separates us, if we get deep down into our material desires, what separates us from Stalin and Hitler and, you know, all these crazy people? You know, you get people to some extent. I have a friend who studied some serial killers, and they're about to, one of them was about to be put to death, and he was speaking about the process of how he became a serial killer. From, you know, obviously it takes a certain mind state, but he he was talking as if he at one point was a normal, God-fearing Christian. In the process, he talked towards becoming, you know, a pedophilic practiced murderer. And it really was like a process. It was like a religious process. Because he was following the deep rooted material desires in his mind. And he had to, and they were unlimited. And he was actually also somewhat blaming modern society's gross advertisements of, you know, and all this softcore pornography and all sorts of horrible things that are out there. I mean, regardless, he was serial. But the point was, if you really start to get into your mind and track down all the really low natures that were developed in contact with material nature, and you follow that, I mean, that's why you have all these groups like Sadhus and all this stuff. Because they start to deer from scripture and go with feeling. And in the end, what happens is the sex impulse comes. Gross or subtle, and the propensity to control. All this stuff comes up, and it really becomes perverted, you know. You have all sorts of horrible things. Men imitating Krishna and sleeping with other men's wives and things like that. And that's it. I can't remember his name, but there's a few sex gurus, major ones. And these people are major. I mean, they have commentaries on Gita and those things, and they're like big gurus still today, and they have thousands of followers, or deep, or, you know, in some pockets of India and the world. They're not small-time people that make these religions. These so-called demons or non-godly people. But you can see, when you self-follow the very growth-based natures of animal instinct and, you know, trying to be God, and you advocate other people to do it, what danger it can become. Recently I was talking with a friend about the differences between the tribes, people of the world, and the English, and the colonists. I said they're both from Lectures. These are both from Lectures. One is unorganized chaos. You know, you have tribes, people, they have some ethics. They eat each other from time to time. And do a few certain pretty horrible things. But they're in the forest, so they don't have much facility. So that's unorganized chaos. And it works to some extent. It can work alongside Vedic culture, which is organized, you know, goodness, organized civilization. But unorganized, I mean, organized chaos is even worse. Prabhupada gives an example of the lazy, unintelligent, which is like a shudra, he just does what he's told, and the active unintelligent, and there it is kind of people. The active unintelligent, so that the organized or the active chaos, which is the colonists, they go around and commit genocide and, like, you know, and destroy ancient civilizations. Like, that's what they do. They do mountains of damage. You know, like, the populations of Australia, of India, of the Americas, and Africa, vastly destroyed just by the diseases that the colonists brought with them. What to speak of their violence, and what to speak of the cultural damage they did by trying to propagate their superiority in religion and economic development of people. So this is the active for all the organized chaos. So this is what these people are doing. If you get to a very high level of authority, and you whatever, you know, great man you come and follow, that's what the Gita says, and that's an instruction to Arjuna, and it's an example of Krishna in the third chapter that said, look, Krishna says, why even do yagis? I'm God. I don't need to do yagis, because yagis only give you, you know, at least yagis to the demigods, they only give you material benefits. Even I do them, because I need to set an example. And you can see the small little things that Krishna did in his personal life, in little villages, in God knows where. You know, his Rasa Leela and all that. Even that, he does these things. He just shows a little bit of his godly nature of enjoyment. And look at what the demons do. Look at what people do. The sages. Lord Chaitanya came 500 years ago. God, according to our philosophy, came 500 years ago. I mean, look at the great people in our history and what they do to the world. You know, how they change, like Jesus Christ. You know, thousands of years now there's this godly theism all over the world. But look at, even God comes 500 years ago, and look at the conversion that happens when people get these things and turn it into their own mental speculation. Even because we have Krishna sages and we have Chaitanya sages. We don't just have Krishna sages, you know, that's 5,000 years ago, but we have more recent ones. And you have all these things coming, and this is God Himself. You know, what to speak of, you know, the devotees and everyone else that come along. And look at Christianity, which has been used to do so many atrocities. It doesn't mean that Jesus was a demon. It doesn't mean that his saints and his followers are or were. It's just that when people, when the demoniac nature comes in contact with anything, it spoils it. Like Prabhupada says, milk with the poison, the touch of the fang of the saint, you know, it's milk. But then there's poison there, and you know, it pollutes the whole thing. So religion, without God as the center, is distracting. And when you implicate gross materialism at the forefront, then it's polluting. Because, you know, materialistic religion on its own is distracting from God, but that's it. But, you know, when you add in some malicious sentiment, then it becomes degrading. So you can look at it like goodness, passion, and ignorance, or however you want. Questions, comments? That's cool. You can wrap up for the budget. Before you go. No. Straightforward. Questions going. Demons crazy. Yeah. Yeah, so I like that point on the lazy fool, I mean, which is most of us. Lazy fool doesn't mean he doesn't do anything at all. Because Prabhupada said no crazy and lazy. But the very moderate, unintelligent folk can serve. You know, they can do things that are positive. But the crazies, or the active fools, those who have no intelligence but want to make a difference, they cause so much damage. And the active intelligent, he is like the Kshatriyas or the Vaishyas, or more Kshatriyas, but you know, he's basically he's governing the world, and he's more intelligent because he has that propensity. But the lazy intelligent prophet calls him, he calls him the spiritualist. And sometimes the Brahmins or the Vaishnavas are looked at lazy and sentimental because they don't do anything. They're inactive. They're active in inactivity. Inactivity is activity and activity. So they're only focusing on Krishna, and they're the highest. So you need them to govern the active intelligent. You need the active intelligent to govern the lazy fools, and you need to rout out the active fools because they're dangerous in society. You know, just want to add that. Nothing. Krishna, you're about to get the key.
the reference forward and no play. Makes. Makes such and such go crazy. First one, all the way through.
What about the second
universe? No, because Andrew Drakenbury said the first one is, he's like kind of really just trying to present it, and the second one he's kind of like, you can, I mean, I saw the documentary and you can see he's trying to like, he's taking out certain parts and then showing how certain bits of it can be shown to represent the universe in a way that's presentable to science. But it doesn't, it's not a full scriptural presentation. It lacks, you know, it ignores some parts of scripture and presents other parts. So whereas the first one is about presenting it all together, which is, you know, more.
It's pretty incoherent, actually, the whole thing. And I would say the second part is actually more coherent, more focused on. But, you know, I'm not sure if I actually heard.
I think the first one is good. I mean, it's pretty sensible. And it does. Yeah. Does really help bring it together, and I also I read 16th and about half of the 17th chapter, all the commentaries that Dajee Maharaj's disciples have put together.
Yeah, I'm looking very careful with them.
Yeah. Well, no, it's not.
Honestly, I've inspired Maharaj to write them because I've been writing letters to him, but in those days it was a little bit more unified.
What he was saying in his books? Or what he
was
saying?
Well, before he was writing in his books.
Yeah.
Because he believes that the universe is 4 billion miles.
Yeah, well, Sadhguru, he says, like you said, he says he pulls up the demigod Yojana, which makes sense. Because we have the Surya Siddhanta, which has.
Well, he says it's not clear.
Yeah, he said it's not clear.
No, because we already discussed this.
Yeah, he presented, exactly.
The problem was I also asked the guys in Mayapur, and they never got back to me. Because, you know, what we got, what we're stuck with kind of is the 5,000 light years number that Prabhupada mentioned to Tathagata Chakramita.
Yeah.
The 18 quadrillion number from Bhaktisiddhanta. Remember that?
Yeah, I know.
Right?
Yeah.
That's about 5,000 light years.
Yeah.
Know this stuff,
no, I know. I mean, I just don't know how many light years it is.
No, you should know the light years because that is very important.
No, because the
Bible. Anyway, 18 quadrillion comes to 5,000 light years. And you know what is the circumference of the Milky Way? Which is just a small thing in the universe. It's 100,000 light years.
Yeah, okay. So it's not big.
So, you know, even the 5,000 light years doesn't really add up.
Yeah.
You can have some. That's how I used to explain it, with this kind of fanatical explanation, but compared to Dhanavi Maharaj, it's very well minded. Because he says 4 billion. You can't even, if you look at Surya Siddhanta, you can't uphold 4 billion.
No, exactly. That's why Sadhguru puts a few different. But his main one was like.
But even 5,000 light years is not. Because the only explanation that I came up with. Mm-hmm. Is that they don't know about redshifts, and that they're, and I haven't looked into it.
Is that the scientists don't? Well, that's a good
thing. Everything on the fact that the stars are like suns.
Yeah.
So their assumption is that the light that comes from the stars is as strong as from the sun.
Mm, yeah.
And therefore, that assumption is wrong, and therefore
the distance is wrong.
The light they're getting from the stars.
It's
according to their assumption further away.
Yeah.
But I don't know if they're that stupid, you know.
Well, no, you know what? Like,
and I don't even know if there is really one sun in the universe. Because they might even talk about our solar system. So I don't know.
Well, the thing is, what Sadhguru Prabhupada does is he points out that actually they don't really know what they're talking about. And if you look at the Redshift documenting, the measurement for
Also says that the 5,000 light years is not very good. It's a problem. It's a big problem.
It's not, like you said, if the Redshift isn't, it's not so much of a problem. The point is,
it is another kind of fanaticism to just chuck away everything the scientists are saying.
Well, he doesn't chuck all of it away. He just kind of says,
anything all of it away. He just says it's not clear.
The thing is with the scientists, the thing is we always have this habit that we list the scientists as one party, but they're not one party themselves, you know what I mean? They don't know the truth.
Well, we're not one party either. We've got the Dhanavir party, we've got the Buddha party, we've got the Dhruta Karma party.
I don't know Dhruta Karma.